We're going to finish up chapter 29 and start chapter 30. We're really in this section. Moses takes kind of a break from the narrative of the wandering and includes this section of restrictions regarding or instruction regarding offering of sacrifices, the making of vows, and those kinds of things. And again, I said last week, I think it's here because they're getting ready to go in the land. And this is a reemphasis of some of the stuff he's told them. And it's also, I think, an encouragement for the people to say, this wandering is coming to an end. We're almost done with this. We've done all this 40 years of wandering, and we're almost finished, almost ready to go in. And so as he hits this, I think it's a reiteration of God's faithfulness to his promise and God's faithfulness to take them into the land that he has promised to take them into. And so there's this preparation time for that as he reiterates or goes over again the sacrifice, really not the actual instructions for the feast, but sacrifice that come with the feast. And we kind of worked our way up until the last of the feast and the Feast of Booths, which is the Feast of Booths was a feast that was a week long, actually 8 day long feast where they would come together. They would come to Jerusalem, or actually I shouldn't say that. Because until the temple was established at Jerusalem, they wouldn't go to Jerusalem. They'd go wherever the tabernacle was. That was where they went. They went to the place where the tabernacle was. That's where God had chosen to make himself known, to make his name reside. And again, that's God's choice because it was God's pillar of cloud and pillar of fire that would determine whether or not that tabernacle moved. So it was clearly God's choice where he was going to have his name reside. And so they would have to go to that place and celebrate this feast. They would go and they would make themselves booths. These booths were two little tents type deal. They would live for this 8 days. They'd live in tents to remember or to have themselves remember the wandering in the wilderness. That's what it was about. It was about to point back to the time when they were wandering in the wilderness. And it's an important feast. It's an important feast because Israel really traced her beginning as a nation to that wandering in the wilderness time. It was when they came out of Egypt and wandered in the wilderness before they entered the land, they really developed their identity as a nation. They didn't have it going into Egypt. When they went down into Egypt, they weren't really a nation yet. When they went down into Egypt, they were 70 people that went down into Egypt. And then while they're in Egypt, they really don't develop any kind of a national identity there because they're under the thumb of Pharaoh, and they're really oppressed and such. And so they really don't develop an identity there. In fact, we know that even when God goes to get them, he has to reintroduce himself to them as who he is. And a lot of the struggles they've had, as we've watched them wander through the wilderness, a lot of the struggles they've had have been because they really didn't understand monotheism. They didn't really understand God that well, who he was. And so they're comparing that, the new way to worship in their minds, with the old way they saw in Egypt all over the place. And so this was a key time for them. And so it's interesting that the first feast that they celebrate is the Feast of Passover. The last feast that celebrates the Feast of Booth, and both of those feasts point them back to this time period. The Passover points them back to coming out of Egypt. The Feast of Booth points them back to the wandering in the wilderness, which is all a point back to the beginning of their nation. And again, you might say, well, I thought the nation began with Abraham, and it did. It did begin with Abraham as people, but the actual nation itself really established an identity and began to live as a nation as they came out of Egypt and as they wandered the wilderness. So that's what the Feast of Booths is all about. They were supposed to do that. So as you walk through the Feast of Booths, you'll notice a lessening of what they needed to bring. It's interesting to me. On the first day, you will bring 13 bulls. The second day, 12 bulls. The third day, 11 bulls. The fourth day, 10 bulls. And it keeps going down all the way to the eighth day, when I think by day eight, you have, what, 7 bulls, I think is what it is? 6 bulls. Actually, it's one bull. Actually, I should say on the seventh day, there's seven bulls. And then the eighth day, it's a holy convocation. There's only one bull offered. So there's this kind of a less, fewer bulls as they go. But I mean, if you look at all the food that's brought for offering on that, during that feast, there's a ton of stuff that's offered that day. So that's something that I found interesting, is that downward progression or downward movement. And again, this is not to tell them how they were to celebrate the feast. This is just to tell them what the sacrifice was on that feast, what the sacrifice was on the feast. And so with the Feast of Booths, he finishes really talking through, walking through the sacrifice of the, and there are three different kinds of sacrifice that he's talked about in chapter 28 and 29. There's three different kinds of sacrifice. He talked about the regular sacrifice, the things they did every day. He talked about their festival offerings, which are the Sabbath ones, the one they did on the Sabbath, their monthly ones they did by month, and then they did their festival offerings, the ones they did for their feasts. So he moves now from the feast, he moves into a section on vows. Chapter 30 is a section on vows. I wish I could figure out how to make this really cool and really interesting, but there's not. It's just a section on vows. That's what it is. And so he starts off with just saying, here's what, if a man makes a vow, he's bound to it. That's basically what he says in a nutshell. He says in chapter 30, verses 1, Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of the people of Israel, saying, this is what the Lord has commanded. If a man makes vows of vows to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. So if a man makes a vow, he's supposed to keep it. If he makes a vow, it's a vow to God. He's supposed to keep the vow to God. If he makes a vow or a binding oath to somebody else, he's supposed to keep the vow. That's what a person in Israel was supposed to do. Jesus is going to talk about God is going to let your yes be yes and your no be no. That's exactly what's being called here. As they commit themselves to do something, they're supposed to do it. That's the way it was supposed to work. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. I find it interesting that it wasn't prohibited from making a vow. There's no prohibition here, don't make vows. It doesn't say that. It says if a man makes a vow, he should keep the vow. There is other teaching, other places that say be careful when you make a vow, but nowhere is there a prohibition found on making a vow or committing. In fact, there are some people who are commanded to make vows, like the Nazirite vow. So what would a vow to the Lord look like? What would a vow to the Lord look like? The Nazirite vow is one vow that's a vow to the Lord. It's a vow just to the Lord. What was a Nazirite vow? Do you remember that? We talked about it. It came up in some of our study to this point. What was a Nazirite vow? Okay, that's one. Don't cut your hair. Good. Don't drink nothing involving grapes at all. No grapes, no raw grapes, no good grapes, no wine grapes, no raisins, nothing with grapes at all. And don't touch a dead thing. Don't touch anything dead. That was a Nazirite vow. Now, we know some Nazirites who took that vow, and they took that vow for life, right? We know a couple of those guys. Who's one guy that took a Nazirite vow and took the Nazirite vow for life? Samson. Samson didn't honor his vow. Samson violated his vow. Actually, Samson didn't take the vow. If you remember, God made the vow for Samson. In the womb, God made the vow for Samson. But Samson was under the Nazirite vow for his entire life. There's another guy who it appears took a Nazirite vow. You're thinking Old Testament, and he's an Old Testament guy, but we know about him in the New Testament, and his name is John the Baptist. More than likely was under a Nazirite vow. Doing the same kind of stuff that a Nazirite would do. So those guys took it for life, but you did not have to take a Nazirite vow for life. It was not a lifetime vow you took. Everybody who took the vow of a Nazirite was that way for their entire life. They could take it for a period of time. They would agree, I'm going to be a Nazirite, I'm going to do the Nazirite vow for a period of time. In fact, it appears that possibly Paul, as he's getting to go to Jerusalem for that last time, it's very possible that Paul has taken a Nazirite vow. We don't know when he took it, but if you watch what happens on his way back, and when he gets back, he has his head, his hair cut, his head shaved. That's what happened when you finished a Nazirite vow. You got your hair, your head shaved because you were finished the vow. So it may be that Paul actually took a temporary Nazirite vow for a period of time. So you could take that vow, but the point is, if you took the vow, you're supposed to keep the vow. If you made the vow, you keep the vow. But it's not just with God. It's not just a vow with God. It's also a vow or an oath between individuals. If you made a commitment, you're supposed to keep your commitment that you made. That's the teaching that it makes sense that would be the case. Now, we know that as you get to the New Testament, there are those who tried to take this vow making and get out of doing things they were responsible to do. The Pharisees, by the time we hit first century Israel, the Pharisees have come up with thing they could say, they could make a vow concerning their properties and their possessions. They could make a vow and they could call it Korban, right? I'm not sure what Korban means, except I know what Korban did. Korban said, everything I have is God's. I made a vow that everything I have is God's. And so therefore, Jesus actually attacks the Pharisees for this one, because when they had parents who were in need, they would say, well, I can't help you because I've vowed everything to God. And so in vowing everything to God, they continued to use the stuff they needed to use to live, but they couldn't help mom and dad because that would be violating their vow to God. So even this can be used as an escape from responsibility, and that's something they shouldn't do. But anyway, the main teaching here is, let your yes be yes, your no be no. If you say a vow, if you swear, make a vow to God, or if you swear an oath to somebody else to bind himself by a pledge, don't break it. And we'd think we could be done, right? We'd think we could be done, except there's a whole rest of a chapter on vows. There's a whole rest of this chapter on vows. And because that's what a man should do, and the rest of the chapter is what happens when a woman makes a vow. What happens when a woman makes a vow? That's exactly what the rest of the chapter is about. And so we have different kinds of women and different responsibilities in the making of vows. And so we're going to walk through those responsibilities. First, the first kind of woman mentioned is an unmarried woman, a woman who is under her father's authority, who lives in her father's house. I will also say this, just so we get don't miss this picture. There's no prohibition here against a woman making a vow. No place does it say here that a woman shall not make a vow. I think that's important because a woman could make a vow to God. A woman could make an equal vow with a guy. You know, we have this idea that even in Bible times, women couldn't do anything, and that's absolutely not true. Absolutely not true. The women had the ability to make a vow, and if they were unattached women, that vow stood just like a man's vow stood. If they were a woman who had, we'll talk about those in a second when we get to divorced and widowed. But if they made a vow and they had no male authority over them, their vow stood. Their vow stood, and their vow was a vow that they were expected to keep equally as a man was to keep his vow. So there's no prohibition, there's no second classness of that. The woman could make a vow, and they're not prohibited from making vows or taking vows or whatever you want to call it, or making pledges. They can enter into agreements. There's no prohibition against that. But so the first one we'll look at is a woman who is unattached, a woman who lives in her father's house. It's verse 3. If a woman vows a vow to the Lord and binds herself by a pledge while within her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow and the pledge by which she has bound herself and says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every pledge which she has bound herself shall stand. So here's the deal. But if he opposes her, then it's null and void. So the girl in the house, the unattached woman living in her father's house, could make a vow. She could make a vow to God, or she could bind herself, make a pledge or oath to somebody else, make a contract with somebody else. And if her father heard that, or when her father heard of that, the very first time her father hears that, the very first time her father knows, he has the opportunity to negate her vow, to make it null and void. Because he is her spiritual authority. He is the authority placed by God over her. He then has the ability and the right to say, no, that vow doesn't stand. that vow, that pledge, that oath, that contract is null and void because I don't approve of it. So the father, her father could say no at that point. But if her father said yes or said nothing, then the vow stood. The vow stood. She was responsible for God for the commitment she made, or she was responsible for the men or the people for the commitment she had made, equally with the guy as in the first two verses of this chapter. Equal responsibility with the vow. The only caveat there is if her father heard about it, or when her father heard about it the first time, if he heard her make it, and I think there's also indication that the first time he knew the vow was made, because she made it in secret, then he found out about it, he could also null and void it the first time he found out about it. But he couldn't, after he found out about it, 3 weeks later, come back and say, you know what, I've thought about that again, and I don't like the fact that you've bound yourself that way, so no, we're gonna eliminate that vow. Couldn't do it. He had a one-time opportunity. One chance to negate the vow, and that was it. Once that opportunity passed, then the vow either stood or was negated for forever. So that's the situation with a woman in her father's house, an unmarried woman in her father's house. There's a second example that Moses talks about. If she marries a husband while under her vows, or any thoughtless utterance of her lips by which she has bound herself, and her husband hears of it and says nothing to her, on the day that he hears of it, her vows shall stand, and her pledges by which she has bound herself shall stand. So, she's moving from authority to an authority. She's moving from her father's house to her husband's house, all right? If she's made a vow under her father's house, and her father didn't say anything about it, and she's bound by it, she's still bound by it, but as she moves from her father's house to her new husband's house, and he hears about a vow that she has made, he has one opportunity to negate that vow. He has one opportunity to say that pledge no longer stands. If he says the vow is negated or the pledge no longer stands, then it's gone. If he doesn't, and he enters the marriage knowing full well what's going on, then everything that she's vowed, everything that she's said, every pledge she's made still stands. That's the one opportunity he gets. One opportunity he gets to negate that. And really, this speaks of authority, not of intelligence. It speaks of authority, not of ability. It speaks of authority because clearly in God's economy, a father is the authority over his daughter, and a husband is the authority over his wife. That's the way that God designed it. And you might not like that, but that is the way God designed it, and that's the way it's supposed to be, that a husband is supposed to be the authority over his wife, and a dad is supposed to be the authority over his daughter. And I think there's clear indication that a dad is authority over his daughter until she's married. Until she's married, or until she moves herself out of that authority. So if she makes a vow when she's young, before she's married, when she gets married, her husband has the opportunity to either to say yes or no. If he's silent of it, then that's approval for the vow to take place, to stand. So that's the first. I believe this also follows. If she, let's keep going. Because now we have this like a parenthetical, verse 9. If any vow of a widow or a divorced woman, anything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. So if a woman is either divorced or widowed in those days, at that time, then she no longer had a male authority over her. And so she was a vow-making authority for herself, and whatever vow she made, whatever oath she pledged, stood. It stood. Because she no longer had a human male authority over her, because she'd been taken out of the authority of a husband through a divorce decree, or she had been taken out of the authority of her husband because her husband was dead. Now there are protections in place. There are laws in place in Israel for the woman to stay underneath some kind of male authority. But there wasn't always the ability for that to happen. For instance, there is the law that if a woman is married to a man and the man dies before she has any of his kids, then there's the kinsman redeemer law that came into play, and that kinsman redeemer said that then her husband's brother should take her as a wife, should take her as a wife and have a son or a child that would be the son of her dead husband. That's the way it works. That's what the kinsman redeemer law is. It was that was there. So there were ways for that to be protected. But once a woman reached an age, if she was a widow and she already had kids from her husband, then there was no requirement for a kinsman redeemer to step in and take his place. Because really, the kinsman redeemer wasn't about providing for the wife. The kinsman redeemer was about providing an heir for the dead husband. That's what the kinsman redeemer is all about. Yeah, Mike? Let me see where you are. But what I read, and I'm going to make sure I read I think you're talking about verse 5. If her father opposes her on the day that he hears of it, if her father opposes it on the day that he hears of it, no vow of hers, no pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will forgive her because her father opposed her. So basically, it's the father takes responsibility and removes her from the vow, and she's forgiven from doing that because her father said no. So let's just walk through this real quick. Let's say a daughter who is really, you know, she's had a great quiet time with her tablet, you know, like a tablet I'm talking about, a stone tablet she's had, and she's read Thou Shalt Not Kill, and that means so much to me. And she had a real good, so I'm going to vow myself, I'm going to take a Nazirite vow for myself for the next 3 years. She does that, right? She is now responsible to God to live as a Nazirite for the next 3 years, right? She can't drink anything from the grapes, she can't touch anything dead, and she can't cut her hair. That's the law. That's what she's vowed herself to do. But her dad looks and says, wait a second, you're nowhere. She's like maybe 14 years old. She's, you know, just, and he recognizes that was an emotional thing she did. He could then say, no, wait a second. I heard you make the vow, or she comes and said, Dad, I made a Nazirite vow. He could say, nah, I don't think so. I don't think so. And he could say to her, I'm your authority, I'm your dad, that vow doesn't stand. That vow doesn't exist, it doesn't stand. And then, so when she violated the vow, the next time she drank grape juice, God wouldn't say, you violated your vow. She would be forgiven by God for the violation of the vow, because it's like it never existed in the first place, all right? So that's a pretty significant caveat, because let's suppose she bound herself in contract to marriage to somebody. When her dad finds out about it, he can say, no, that doesn't exist. There's no way that contract, it's not happening. Not happening. And so there'd be no requirement then. Because if you also understand that when a contract was made for marriage in those days, usually there was a bride price that was paid. So, you know, dad could say, I'm not paying that guy nothing. And it would be okay. It would be okay. Matt. Ruth's commitment to Naomi would have been, I believe, I want to make real clear what I'm saying here. Ruth's commitment to Naomi would have been a vow. When she said, I am basically vowing myself to be your daughter, your people be my people, your God my God, she is clearly making a vow. She, at that point, however, is not bound by Mosaic law because she's not a Jew. Okay? Yet. She's going to make herself a Jew, but she's not yet. I also want to make it real clear that what Boaz does is not a kinsman redeemer type thing. That's a different law. What's the name of the law, Ron? What's the? You should know this. You're sleeping over there, huh? That's Leveret, and that's different than kinsman redeemer. But I'm not going to go there right now. I just want to make sure that we don't confuse what happened with Ruth with the kinsman redeemer law, because it's not the same thing. But that's as far as we're going today. I'm not going to explain that. Maybe in 25 years when we get to the book of Ruth, we'll talk about that. But not until then. I know that we only got Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, but we got Deuteronomy in the middle of there, and that's a seven-year book. So just so you know, Deuteronomy is a seven-year book. It took 5 years on Thursday morning, so I'm sure it's going to be 7 years on Sunday school. Where were you? So I think that's the point. The point is, if the girl makes a vow, dad hears about it and says, no, he didn't, no, you didn't, then she's not held accountable for the violation of the vow. That's the point. It's like the vow never got made. That's what the dad has the right to say. When she moves from her dad's authority to her husband's authority, her husband can do the same thing and say, no, that's done, and the vow's eliminated. Okay? If he says nothing, the vow stands. The vow stands and it stays in place. The vow or the pledge stands and stays in place. If he dies or divorces her and then she makes a vow, it stands. Or if she's made a vow that's in place, he dies or divorces her, it still stands. There's no getting out of it at that point. So that's all. That's a single girl under her father's authority that moves into a husband's authority, having made a vow. Okay. Then you have the widow or divorced woman. That's the third category. There's a fourth category. That's a woman who vows a vow while she's living in her husband's house. So while she's married to her husband, if she vowed in her husband's house or bound herself by a pledge with an oath, and her husband heard of it and said nothing to her and did not oppose her, then all her vows shall stand, and every pledge by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband makes them null and void on the day that he hears them, then whatever proceeds out of her lips concerning her vows or concerning her pledge or herself shall not stand. Her husband has made them void. The Lord will forgive her. So same type idea, what the dad could do, now the husband can do. If she's going to make a vow, he hears of it, he can make it null and void. It's if it never happened. Never happened. And any vow and any binding oath to afflict herself, her husband may establish on her, may make. I'm trying to read that one. Any vow, any binding oath or establishment may establish on her or make. Okay, so basically the husband has the right to say it stands or it's void. So that's what he's saying there. I couldn't make that verse make sense in my head. I know I'd read it 50 times, but for some reason today it didn't make sense. I thought it was saying something it didn't say. So basically then that the deal is her husband can say it exists or her husband say it doesn't. But again, if her husband doesn't say anything, hasn't done anything, the day he finds out about it, the day he hears about it, he says nothing, he doesn't have a 3-week right of refusal to come back and say, well, sorry, I guess I don't want that vow to stand. He's got one chance, one opportunity, and once he says nothing or lets it go, then it's an established vow. It's an established vow. But if he makes it null and void, here's what you're talking about, I think, Mike. Verse 15. But if he makes them null and void after he's heard of them, then he shall bear her iniquity. That is, after he hears of it. That's post the one chance. If he decides 3 weeks later, you know what, we're not going to do that, she doesn't bear the iniquity anymore, he does. He does. It's on him now for making her violate the vow that he said nothing about in the first place. So he takes responsibility for. And that's to give some teeth to the law. That's to give some teeth to the law. So husband can't just come back 3 weeks later and say, no, we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. We decided against it. So there's got to be teeth because now it's on the husband. He will bear that responsibility. So then he, the summary statement at the end, he says, and then these are the statutes the Lord commanded Moses about a man and his wife and about a father and his daughter while she is in her youth within her father's house. So this is really the from chapter 30, verse 3 to the end of chapter 30 really is instruction on what does it look like for a woman, a single woman or a woman in Israel, in life in Israel when she makes a vow or when she does something. So that's what's the point. And that's the interesting thing is that's the most teaching in all of the law, all of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, that's the most teaching on a woman's responsibility that we have. Those 27 verses. That's pretty significant. So those are pretty important verses for how life for a woman was in Israel in that day. She did have rights. She did have responsibilities. She could bind herself legally. She could do stuff. We already saw earlier where the daughters of the guy came because they had no brother, and they asked for inheritance. And Moses said, "Yeah, you get an inheritance." So there were rights for women. We don't want to get the idea that women were just trampled underfoot and had no responsibility and no legal authority. That's absolutely not true. Absolutely not true. They had to have had some, because they could bind themselves in a vow to God. They could bind themselves and pledge an oath to each other or to other people. They had the right and authority to do so. But there was just one caveat for a married woman or a woman under authority. She had a layer between her and the keeping of that covenant. Like I said, I wish I could make that really interesting and make that really mean something, but I'd have to really spiritualize the text to make it say anything that it doesn't say. It's about that. It's not about anything else. So should we live like that today? Should we live like that today? Boy, I'm opening up cans of worms here. This is the Mosaic law. We are not under the law. We are not under the law, right? If we're going to say that this passage makes us live like this, then you better stop eating bacon. And I know no one wants to do that, right? If this passage says that, then you need to start wearing tassels on the ends of your clothes. If this passage says that, then you need to stop cutting the sides of your hair and let them grow down. If this passage says that, then you got to be real careful. And if you're going to keep that and suggest that that is a passage, then you've got to keep the whole law. That means, I don't know how you're going to finance this, but you need to make it to Jerusalem 3 times next year. You need to. And maybe that sounds excessive and silly, but if you're going to take this passage and say, see, here's what it means, then you got to take the whole law and say, see, here's what. Now, what do we know? What do we know about how we're supposed to live? Well, we do know for a fact. We do know for a fact, because of other teaching like Ephesians chapter 6, we know that children should obey their parents, right? We know that. Why do we know that? Because as we're talking about Ephesians 5, when Paul says to the Ephesian church, be filled with the Spirit, he then goes through a list of things that say, how are you filled with the Spirit? What does the Spirit filling do for you? And one of the things that Spirit filling does for you is causes children to obey their parents. So a Spirit-filled child will obey his parents. Will obey his parents. If you understand the command in that whole passage, the command in that whole passage is be filled with the Spirit. And then there's a lot of participles that come after that that tell you what it looks like. Like, for instance, be filled with the Spirit, and then he says, submitting yourselves to one another. And it's interesting, Ephesians 5:22, where he says, wives, submit yourselves to your husband. Actually, that word submit yourselves is not even there. It's not even there. It's actually a wives to your own husbands. So here's the thought. Be filled with the Spirit. Be filled with the Spirit, submitting yourselves to one another, wives to your own husbands, as to the Lord. I'm going to preach that here in a few weeks. So I've really spent a lot of time there. Is there an example or an idea that children should obey their parents in the New Testament? Absolutely there is. Absolutely there is. But don't take it back to the law where it says honor your father and mother. Okay? Because that's the Jewish law. Is there teaching in the New Testament that says that a wife, and I'm being real careful here, come back on July 14th, I think it is. July 14th, I preach Ephesians 5:22-24, and I'll lay it out for you what it looks like, what I'm talking about in submission. I won't do that. I'll do it for you. But is there clear teaching that a wife should submit, place herself under the authority of her husband? Absolutely there is. But it's not found in Numbers chapter 30. If you're going to take Numbers chapter 30 as the commandment for you to do that, then you better, and husbands, if you're using Numbers chapter 30 as a bully pulpit to beat your wife over the head with and say, submit woman, submit woman, submit woman, look here, I can even null and void your contracts. If you're doing that, you're really making a mistake unless you're keeping the whole law. And if you are keeping the whole law, then you're trying to get to heaven by yourself, and that's a big problem. That's a really big problem. So I would suggest you stop it now. But women, I did not just give you permission to oppose your husband. I didn't do that either, because there's clear teaching in the New Testament where we're told, we're called to mutually submit to each other, and wives submit to their own husband. That's a clear call. You come back on the 14th, and we'll talk about that. So I just want to make sure that this passage isn't used in a way it was never intended to be used, because it's not. That's not what it's about. So that's vows. That's vows, and we have a little bit about the interaction between men and women and how life looked for a woman in Israel at that day. So I got 10 minutes-ish. All right, let's move forward. As we move from chapter 30 now, we close that parenthetical section. That section that Moses kind of stepped away from the narrative, you know, you had narrative all the way up there. Now we step away, and we step right back into... Where were we when we left? Do you remember where we were when we left this? What had just happened? What had just happened when we left? It's open book. You can actually turn back to chapter 27, 20. You can actually turn back and look. What has happened just before this parenthetical? Well, just before Joshua was commissioned. Balaam. That's a big deal. Because if you track what's going on, it's in the narrative, you have the Balaam story, you have Joshua's commissioning, and in the narrative, then you have go to war against Midian. In the text, we have Balaam story, Joshua commissioned, this parenthetical, which took us like 6 weeks to get through, and go to war against Midian. So in the flow of thought, it kind of loses continuity. But if you take that parenthetical out of the way, which we're not taking it out of the Bible, it should be there. We're just going to take it out of the way for a second and continue the narrative. You have the Balaam situation, Balaam-Balak situation, you have Joshua commission, and now you have go to war. Go to war against them. Make them pay for what they did. And they're going to be made to pay for what they did. God says this in chapter 31, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, avenge the people of Israel and the Midianites. And afterward, you should gather your people. Now, did you hear that? God says to Moses, go avenge the people. Go avenge the people of Israel on the Midianites. So go get vengeance on the Midianites. We're going to talk about that in just a second. And when you're done, you'll die. I think I might put that battle off a little bit. Okay, let's wait 3 weeks, God. You know, whatever. No, because Moses, the deal is, you're going to go take vengeance, and then you're going to die. Well, Moses doesn't die right away. He gets to say some last things to Israel. He gets to make four last major speeches to Israel, and those are Deuteronomy. Those four last major speeches that he makes to Israel, Deuteronomy. But the point here is, go avenge the people of Israel. I mean, so why is God so upset at the Midianites? Why is he so upset at the Midianites? You remember in the whole deal that was talked about earlier, as they were getting ready to go to the land, God actually said to Moses, don't mess with Moab and don't mess with Midian. So now why is God so mad at the Midianites? What did they do? They tried to curse Israel, right? They were part of the group that tried to curse Israel. Remember, it was Moab and Midian that came together. They sent the elders of Moab and Midian together, where it was Balaam was more than likely a Midianite. So you had, that was part of it, and it was Balaam who gave them the idea, that, hey, go seduce them into worshiping false idols. That was his plan. That was his thought. And we're going to find out about that actually here in this chapter. But the reason that God was so upset with the Midianites is because they had tried to perpetrate disaster on his people. And he didn't take kindly to that. He doesn't take kindly to other gods being exalted above him. And so now he's going to go and exalt himself and avenge himself on them, on them. So Moses speaks to the people, says, arm men from among you for war, that they may go against Midian to execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian. You shall send 1,000 from each of the tribes of Israel to war. So how many? I just think this is something that we're going to take a little offside trail here for a second. What's the nation they're going against? Midian. How many are they taking? 12,000, right? 1,000 from each tribe. 1,000 from each tribe. I thought there were 13 tribes. Yeah, Levites didn't go to war. Okay, Levites didn't participate in war. So 12 tribes. 12,000 people went. All right? You remember another battle against Midian? We haven't covered it yet in our text because it's later. Remember another battle against Midian? Gideon, right? It rhymes. It almost rhymes. It's almost like go find Gideon, he fought Midian, whatever. it's like a cheer. It's interesting that Gideon starts off with 32,000, ends up with 300. Moses starts off with no one and ends up with 12,000. So it's kind of weird as I think about stuff. Anyhow, so there's this is actually the first time they go to war against Midian, but they're going to have Midian as a problem for really a lot of their history. Midian is going to continue to be a problem for them. So they send 12,000 people armed for war, and they have a huge success. Moses sent them to the war at 1,000 from each tribe together. So I guess I should keep you in. So the first thing you have is, as Moses' last campaign against Midian, if you're keeping the notes, then you have the battle report. Here's the battle report. It was a great success. It was a great victory as they went through. Verse 7, they warred against Midian, the Lord commanded, and they killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian with the rest of their slain, and there are the names Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, the five kings of Midian. They also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. So now we know how Balaam died. That's the guy. That's the guy whose donkey talked to him. He saved him for a week. She saved him for a little bit of time, but yeah, he was eventually God took him out of the way. And the people of Israel took captive the women of Midian and their little ones, and they took it as plunder, all their cattle, their flocks, all their goods, all their cities and places where they lived, all their encampments they burned with fire, and took all the spoil and the plunder both of man and of beast, and they brought the captives and the plunder of the spoil to Moses and Eleazar the priest and the congregation of the people of Israel and the camp of the plains of Moab by the Jordan of Jericho. So they had this incredible victory. They killed everyone who came out to fight them in battle. They took captive everybody who was left, and it was great. It was great victory. And so then they're going to divide the spoils. That comes next, the division of the spoils. How are they going to get it? And they took Moses actually. Tells them, here's one more thing I want you to do. They're going to actually do more than just take them captive. You're actually going to kill some of the captives now. Because verse 14, Moses was angry with the officers of the army and the commanders of thousands, the commanders of hundreds who had come in the service of war. Moses said to them, have you let all the women live? Behold, these on Balaam's advice caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against the Lord in the incident of Peor. And so the plague came among the congregation of the Lord. Now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones and kill every woman who has known a man by lying with him. But all the young girls who have not known a man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. So this is pretty drastic. It's pretty drastic. First of all, they've killed all the men. They've taken cities. Now Moses says, and besides that, now everybody else needs to die too, really. There's very few people going to be left. Why is that? Well, if you need to understand what God is doing. God is trying to purify a people. God is trying to purify a people for himself, and he knows the propensity of man, he knows the propensity of this people to go after other gods, to go after false things, and the way they went after false things was to go after them through false worship with these women. And so he doesn't want any kind of a situation to exist where that could potentially happen again. And so he says, we need to cut it off. We need to stop it. They need to be taken out of the way. They need to be killed. We'll talk more about this next week. It's 9:45. I'm really trying to stop at 9:45 because if people got to go get their kids, things like that. Please, I'm going to let you go. Go get your kids and pick them up, take them where they need to be, and get back here by 10 o'clock. We'll see you soon. Bye.